Hi. Before we begin, I wanted to take a moment to commemorate the passing of Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who died aged 72. Beyond the intellectual powerhouse that was Rabbi Sacks, I remember someone with an unbelievable sense of humanity and comic timing. I wanted to share two short stories. At university, there was an advertised meal with Rabbi Sacks. The dessert came and went and he still wasn't there. Then suddenly he appeared. He gave a 10-minute inspirational speech, of which he was the master, then screamed, "Get me a drink!" To which someone rushed him a whiskey. He downed it, then started clapping and singing. He got everyone in a giant circle dancing. There were a good 200 people there. And then on the second time round, ran out the door without anyone noticing. Absolutely brilliant. The second story was a few years later. I was part of a lay leadership course which culminated in going to Rabbi Sacks' house and asking him a question. One of my fellow participants asked about how to increase child engagement in shul, synagogue life. After a long 2 minutes with no end in sight, I interrupted and said, "But shul is boring." She responded that I couldn't read Hebrew and couldn't follow a service. I replied that not only could I read Hebrew, I had taken services. We then both realised where we were as Rabbi Sacks leaned in, stroked his beard, and in his soothing tones stated, "Yes, shul is boring." Baruch Dayan Emmet. Rabbi Sacks was an intellectual powerhouse who will be sorely missed. Beyond his long list of writings, he taught me that much can be said in few words, which, let's be honest, is a lesson I'm still trying to learn. Anyway, on with the show.
Sorry.
Whoa. You're gonna cut. That was as dramatic as the election.
Yeah, you're going to cut that out, right?
We'll see.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Bagel Podcast. I'm Hayden Cohen. In this episode, we have our usual Israel update from journalist Gilad Halpin. Madeline Young delves into how Black Lives Matter affects the Jewish community. Rabbi Harvey Belofsky shares some high-concept Talmud. And this episode's Bagel Broigus is The Future of Gender and Judaism, featuring Sally Berkovich, Michelle Janes, and Rabbi Daniel Lishman. But first, in light of the recent US elections, I chatted with Associate Professor of American Politics at Tufts University, Eitan Hirsch. So I have the pleasure to be joined by Eitan Hirsch, who is Associate Professor of American Politics at Tufts University. And we have just had an election in America. I think it's suffice to say that you know what you're talking about. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us here at The Bagel.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here with you.
I want to focus, because obviously it's a Jewish podcast, on how the Jewish community have voted. And I'm particularly interested in this almost parallel of 70 to 80%, dependent on which polls you look at, that US Jews voted for Biden versus, say, support in Israel. It's probably similar in the UK, to be honest. About 70 to 80% of Jews would vote Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think there's that difference?
Well, you know, the U.S. population of Jews is very, very diverse. We have, you know, a big chunk of ultra-Orthodox in pockets in, you know, New York and a few other places. We have a small Mizrahi community from different places, but we have, a very large group of essentially liberal in terms of their Jewish practice and a long tradition of liberal politics here. I mean, since Franklin Roosevelt, Jews in the United States have been overwhelmingly Democrats. And there's a small group for whom Israel is essentially their only issue, just as there's a group of Americans who they're pro-life, right? That's their main, not Jews per se, but there's a large group of Americans who will vote Trump no matter what, or vote Republican no matter what, because they're pro-life, they're single issue voters. And there are clearly a group of Jews in America who are single issue voter on Israel. And I think that they can point to a number of policy victories from Trump with respect to Israel. And so, you know, their vote is simply a reflection of that. But the vast majority of Jews in America either are not single issue voters with respect to Israel or are not keen on the policy positions regarding Israel that President Trump took, or probably some combination of those two things.
So I don't know what it's like, obviously, in the States, but here when I see those who are
pro-Trump that come at it from a perspective of Biden is going to be responsible for, you know, the decimation of the Jews. He's going to be responsible for increased anti-Semitism. And it's very difficult to respond to that because I haven't seen any evidence of it. And to get that balance right, how does a US community deal with the balance between the reality and the perception?
Well, the reality is that violent anti-Semitism in the United States comes largely from the right. We've had examples in the Trump era. We've had, of course, the Charlottesville March, where you have hundreds and hundreds of white nationalists chanting, "Jews will not replace us." We've had synagogue shootings, mostly coming from white nationalists. So in terms of people feeling threatened, I mean, you know, the synagogue where I attend, where my children go to their preschool, the security there, they're looking mostly for white nationalists. That's the physical threat that people perceive. Now, there's pockets of violent anti-Semitism that's not white nationalist. We've had also synagogue shootings from, Louis Farrakhan, Nation of Islam perpetrators. But I think on the left, the concern that's antagonistic to the left sees that there's a number of politicians on the left who are not particularly sympathetic to Israel's battles with the Palestinians. I mean, you see situations like Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, who wouldn't attend a ceremony honoring Yitzhak Rabin because I guess she deemed Yitzhak Rabin too right-wing, or I don't know what. Yeah, I think something like that, people say, like, holy moly, that's really quite antagonistic, even toward the token liberal peacemaker of Israel who was killed for making peace efforts. You know, if that's Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez's views, like, you know, I'm out of here. I think that's the dispute. There's a lot of concern among some people on the right that view is prominent in the Democratic Party. I don't think there's actually much evidence of that. I mean, for sure, it's growing and younger people seem to be less sympathetic in America to Israel on the left. But like all the time with anti-Semitism, we confront it from every direction. And so there's a clear threat on the right that's violent. There's a clear threat on the left for folks who want to see politicians in the United States line up with Israel. And, you know, I don't think it's as much of a feeling of personal threat, but certainly policy threat. And of course, this is also inextricably tied to Israel's own decisions in its democratic practices. I would say probably, if I had to guess, although this is not, I don't have survey data about, actually, we do have survey data about this. We have survey data that's actually most American Jews do not like Netanyahu. They love Israel, right? I mean, you have 95% of American Jews saying they support Israel and they love Israel. And they mean probably something like the culture, the religion, the people, the land, they love all that. But when it comes to politics, I mean, Bibi Netanyahu doesn't represent their politics. They wouldn't vote for him if they were in Israel, if they had the right to vote there. So I think the alignment of Netanyahu and Trump has probably, you know, heightened tensions along all of these dimensions as well.
Are those tensions on denominational lines? So is it, you know, if you're of the more progressive movements, say Reform, Conservative, etc., that you'll be more likely to vote Biden Democrat, whereas if you're, the more religious you are, the more likely you are to vote Trump? Or is it not quite as simple as that?
There's two dimensions, right? So there is that dimension, which is for sure there. I mean, even if you divide the Orthodox world into sort of modern Orthodox and yeshivish Orthodox, the yeshivish ones are very, very for Trump. Modern Orthodox is more split, although probably 55-60% for Trump, if I had to guess. And then all of the liberal branches are overwhelmingly Democratic. Reform, conservative, I mean, overwhelmingly Democratic. And in many, you know, modern Orthodox synagogues as well, OU synagogues, it's probably pretty split. But I would say there's another dimension that's also important, which is that people of all religious backgrounds who are most interested in Jewish politics or Israel politics, the people who show up at AIPAC conferences, regardless of how religious they are, tend to reflect more conservative values when it comes to Israel, strong defense, and things like that. There was a survey in the United States of American Jews. You know, it's very rare. We don't have that many surveys of American Jews. And a survey basically said that the Jewish community was way to the left of the Jewish establishment with respect to Israel. And so one of the newspapers interviewed Abraham Foxman, head of the Jewish establishment, and they said, "What do you think of this, Mr. Foxman? You know, you're way out of step with the American Jews, according to this survey." And this is the great quote. Foxman said, "Oh, I don't represent all Jews. I represent Jews who care." that actually personally rubbed me the wrong way. So I wanted to go, I opened up the survey data myself. I downloaded the data. I opened it up. I tried to, you know, quantify, what does it mean, people who care? And sure enough, Foxman is exactly right. You know, no matter how you divide the Jewish population of the country, the ones who are involved, who belong to organizations, who make donations, who ritually are involved, who they are quite to the right of the rest of the Jewish community. So when we say American Jews, we see a left-leaning group, but most of those people are completely disengaged, don't belong to a synagogue, are not involved in any kind of community affairs. And so if you survey them, they look very liberal. But if you survey people who are actually involved, either religiously or civically, it's a different story.
And just because of what happened with all the various polling, do you think that those numbers are about right? So do you think it is 70% of US Jews? Or can any polls be trusted anymore, I suppose, is a question I'm asking.
Well, first of all, on this front, we've had consistent numbers like that for the Jewish community for years now. I mean, it's always wavered, you know, 65, 75. It's always around, I would say, between 2/3 and 3/4 of Jewish identifiers for years have been Democrats. So I don't think we have reason to believe there's a big change. What we do see is that the ultra-Orthodox community is growing and is very, very aligned right now with Trump. It's not just about Israel, I don't think. I mean, some of the, of course, as we know, some of the ultra-Orthodox groups are, you know, not even Zionists. It's not necessarily as strictly about Israel, but I think they see an alignment of values.
Is there anything else that I should be asking?
I mean, I think this is an important topic. I'm actually about to field a large survey of anti-Semitic attitudes among young Americans. And I've never worked on this area myself. I study, you know, voting rights, civic engagement, U.S. elections. I've never studied anything like this. But I think it's of growing concern. And it's of growing concern, first of all, because we have an increase in actual anti-Semitic incidents. They're getting it from the left and the right. I don't know all the details about what your country has gone through with the Labor Party and anti-Semitism. But what I can say here is that I think for a lot of American Jews, the Republican Party is not an option because it is right now home to a growing vocal group of white nationalists. And the Democratic Party is normally their home base, but there is some concern about a growing anti-Israel and potentially bleeding into anti-Semitic position taking over there. So I think if I'm going to psychoanalyze the community here without data, I would say I can understand why people feel squeezed.
So before we go, I know you've got a book out. I just want to tell us a bit about the book.
Sure. So the book is called Politics is for Power. And it's about these two concepts that I think it's mostly American stories, but there are some, you'll see some nice British themes as well. So the book is basically about how well-educated liberals in the United States have increasingly done politics like it's their hobby, like it's their sports fans, and they obsessively follow it. They comment on it. They're amateur pundits. They'll maybe throw a $5 donation or sign an online petition, but they don't really do it. They're not really trying to achieve any goals. They have no strategy. And the alternative to political hobbyism, of course, is real politics, trying to get other people to take actions they wouldn't otherwise take by building long-term power for the things you care about. So you see in the United States, particularly in the Trump era and before, leading up to the Trump era, you see people who will spend 2 hours a day, you know, on Twitter, but they belong to no community organizations. They don't do a thing. And we also see, I think, democratizing reforms that are meant to help people engage, but help us engage in the shallowest way, whether it's ballot initiatives where we vote on individual things or online petitions. So advanced rich countries, there is this really huge problem, which is that the people who are best educated and have time to engage in politics just do it in the stupidest way. They are not trying to serve any goals. And then they're surprised when people who they don't like are trying harder than they are. You know, in the beginning of the book, I give an example from 2 years ago, 2018, in North Carolina, where the Ku Klux Klan was going around to opioid addicts and saying, you know, do you have an opioid addiction? It's not your fault. We here at the White Knights of the KKK are here to help you. And I tell this story at the beginning of the book because I want readers to say, holy,
oy!
You know, is this what the other side is doing? Is this how white, like, they're not just going on marches with their torches. They're like looking people in the eye and they're helping people. And if they're doing that, am I doing that? Am I also like going and responding to people's needs? And the answer is usually no. And so I think the story of the book is that when we engage in political hobbyism, we cede political power to people who frankly want it more than we do.
Professor Eitan Hirsch, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And now for our Israel update with Gilad Halpin.
What is really going on?
So again, I'm joined by Gilad Halpin here to discuss what's going on in Eretz Yisrael. How are you doing, Gilad?
Hi, Hayden. I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, good. I think it's safe to say that it's still Friday morning, and I'm time checking it as the conversation will become very clear at 7:41 a.m. British time. It is looking like it's going Biden's way. So let's, on the basis that it'd be Biden, what would that do for Israel?
Well, not much, I think. It's been 4 years of paradise for the Israeli government, with Trump letting them do really whatever they want, and also realizing Netanyahu's and the Likud's and the right wings in general wet dream, which is to sideline the Palestinians to the extent that they're really not being taken into account at all. The thing is that it works for them very, it has worked for them very well, and it might have continued to work for them for the foreseeable future, or maybe not the foreseeable future, the near future. And then beyond that, I don't know whether it would have served Israel purposes as much as Netanyahu and Likud and the right wing claims. The thing about Biden is that he's no Ilhan Omar and he's no Bernie Sanders and he's no Elizabeth Warren. He's a centrist candidate known for his support for Israel in the Senate for decades. I don't think we're going to see anything different from what we saw under Democratic administrations in the past, namely Clinton and Obama, which is firm support for Israel, but within the confines of the status quo, that doesn't bode well for the Palestinians either and for the peace process in Israel in general. The interesting thing that remains to be seen is whether Trump's likely defeat is going to have some sort of ripple effect on Netanyahu. When one falls, the other falls with him. On the one hand, Netanyahu's status as prime minister has seemed more precarious than ever over the last few weeks and months.
I feel like you've been saying that for years, though. So.
No, that's what I'm saying. On the other hand, he's proved incredibly resilient. So it remains to be seen how the politics of America, the tectonic shifts across the pond, will unfold in Israel, if at all.
Yeah, so let's go away from the American election a bit. So let's go to happier talk of COVID. How's that all going in Israel at the moment?
You know, as they say about Israel, we don't believe in miracles, we just rely on them, right? I think this is pretty much what has characterized the government response. And we'll see how we'll emerge from it. Right now, external debt has skyrocketed. Unemployment has been 4 months now at an almost all-time high. And another problem is that for political reasons between the two main parties composing the coalition government, basically the public service has come to a standstill. The last budget that was approved by the government was for 2018. So because Israel has been in three consecutive election campaigns and then in the COVID crisis with an emergency government. The government has not yet published or, of course, approved a state budget for 2019 and even 2020. The thing is that in March, when the current government was set up, they said that the first thing they'd do was publish a state budget for 2020, because a state cannot function without a state budget, of course. That has been postponed time after time, allegedly because of Netanyahu's refusal to do it. And there's every reason in the world to believe that this is really the case, because he is the prime minister and the finance minister is from his party. And the thing is that they say that the reason for that is that if a state budget is not approved, according to the law, the government is dissolved within 3 months and an election is called. And they say that this Netanyahu would like to keep that option open to call an election whenever he sees serving his political needs. So right now, the deadline has been extended from August to December, which is ridiculous because a state budget for 2020 cannot be published in late December. And currently, what they say is that they're working on the budget for the last 7 days of 2020. Yes, exactly. This is, I mean, if it wasn't tragic as hell, we'd be laughing. But it seems now, and this is all the reports that we've been hearing, that really there's actually no work being done on the budget for next year. If the budget is approved, then Netanyahu would have to abide by the coalition agreement and hand over the prime ministership to Benny Gantz in November next year. And by not approving state budget, that will be his only way out of it without having to incur any sanctions. Especially given that there isn't, right now, any serious challenger on the left. There's one on the right, that's Naftali Bennett, who's the leader of the far-right party and the settler party called Yamina, who quite astutely, from the beginning of COVID, when people in government and in the opposition were still downplaying its effects, he was single-mindedly focused on tackling the social and economic effects of COVID. And he's written a book called How to Beat a Pandemic, and was really working around the clock to think of potential government plans to tackle it. And strangely enough, it has given him a tremendous boost in opinion polls. And he's now touted to become the second largest party in Knesset, very close to Likud, that's about to lose a fair few seats. And the big question is whether he would collaborate with Netanyahu or not. Because on the one hand, he is right wing, and he's one of Netanyahu's obvious coalition partners. On the other, there's a great deal of enmity between the two men. Also, Bennett has been criticizing Netanyahu left, right, and center about the mismanagement of COVID. So it would be a tremendous U-turn to say, okay, he's been prime minister, now I'm going to support him in government, which is not impossible. Of course, it is politics at the end of the day. So I think the biggest enigma right now, that if indeed Yamina performs so well in the next election, whether they would support Netanyahu and give him the majority that he's yearning for, or be true to their previous statements and say, okay, Netanyahu is indeed a right-wing prime minister and someone that we should be supporting, but it's been bad for Israel and now it's time for change, and maybe set up a coalition with centrist parties or whatever. But that really remains to be seen, and both options are equally plausible.
Gilad Halpern, thank you very much.
Thank you, Hayden. It's a pleasure as always.
And now to talk of Black Lives Matter and to share her lived experience, Madeline Young. So I'm now joined by social economist and senior lecturer Madeline Young, who's here to chat with us about BLM, about racism in the Jewish community, that type of thing. How are you doing?
I am doing very well. Thank you for asking. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, I think we should just get into it. How can we convince Jews that don't get it that they should be supportive?
I think some people, unknown to themselves, are racist. Yeah, there are racist Jews. Just like there are, you know, there are, I don't want to say just like, because it's Jews and Black isn't a dichotomy. Jews and people of African origin isn't a dichotomy. And that's where people get things wrong, right? So people have ethnicity and then they have their religion, and you can have any ethnicity and be of any religion. That's a problem that Jewish people have. And I think people want to kind of shortcut and be like, well, I can't care anymore. So I can't care about that cause because some of them don't like Israel. And imagine being talked to by the cops and you end up dead. You can't imagine that in this country. If I have trouble, I call the cops. I feel safe. I don't think the cops are ever going to hurt me in the United Kingdom. In the United States, you can end up dead. And Black men especially, they do end up dead. And that's what this whole BLM is. It's like, stop killing Black people. That's the movement. You know, when it forays into, you know, anti-Israeli, let's hook up with the Palestinians, that's a side issue. I think we need to make sure we look at the main issue, which is, let's not have Black people be killed because of just being Black.
So on that, let's pivot to your Jewish experience. Has race impacted your Jewish experience? And if it has, how?
I was born in America and my parents met in France, then moved to America. I grew up in a community that was like lefty, liberal, feminist, intellectual, Ashkenazi women, hippies. And that was my world. It was like France. I moved to France where my mom's from. And I realized like, oh my gosh, like France has got a different kind of racism. And I've just moved to this country. In my hometown, I felt comfortable being who I was because I grew up there. But now I'm in a different country. People are treating me differently. Because I have that ancestry, I have melanin in my genes. It comes out very strong sometimes. And then my hair is very thick and people recognize that I am not totally European and they see it. And racist people are looking for that because they're racist. And I noticed that I would be looked at or treated badly or not given proper customer service, or I'd have a difficult time at the bank. And I would have a difficult time applying for jobs because of my hair. It shows my ethnicity is not totally European. But if I tied my hair up or braided my hair or attached it, then because I have these lovely green eyes, then I'm all of a sudden white. So I realized that I had to consciously on a daily basis hide my ethnicity. And that is an experience of a lot of people who are of a combination of European and African origin in a racist place. It's like, I have this privilege that I can hide my ethnicity. Other people can't. So it's a horrible privilege because it means that every day I wake up and I'm like, how ethnic can I look today? Is it safe to be ethnic? And then I moved here and then I realized if I tie my hair up or this and that, then, and I'm in a Jewish setting, people don't think I'm Jewish. You know, British people are nice, they're polite. This is a cultural thing. But I found that like people ask invasive questions depending on my hairstyle, my fashion, and how I present myself. And I don't want to talk about my ethnicity and have my Judaism questioned. I just don't.
I completely understand that. On the flip side, like, how does someone working security at a shul do what they need to do in a way that keeps a community safe, but also...
Yeah.
Doesn't invade someone's perfectly legitimate and honest privacy.
The thing is, I used to be CST. Yeah. So I've done all that training and CST is very clear about how we train people. And you can't use your own ethnic bias to do security. That is not the way to do security. So you've been to Israel, right?
Yeah.
They grill all of us, don't they?
Right.
Right. You can be Shloimeh Rosenberg. You're going to get grilled by the security because that's how you do security. Someone shows up at the door. They could be Lily White, you know, whatever, John Smith. He could be a terrorist. They could be, you know, whatever, very different looking person and wearing a yarmulke, comes up with his, you know, sitter and his tallit under his arm. Shabbat Shalom. You ask the security question. Security needs to be done consistently and not in a racist way. I think that the presumption needs to be in a synagogue, everyone's Jewish. And the behavior needs to be, I've never seen you before. I should go up and say hello. Yeah, I've had friends who were born Jewish, who are Black, and they go to the synagogue and the security won't let them in the door to go pray on Shabbat. And it's like, how can you not just cry? Black Lives Matter is even beyond not being able to get into synagogue. It is being killed. It is being beaten in the streets. It is dying in the hospital because the doctors aren't taking care of you. So Black Lives Matter is, let's imagine that we went to the hospital and you're pregnant and you're Jewish and they didn't help you deliver and you die of childbirth and you lose your, God forbid, you lose your wife because the doctor doesn't treat her well because she's Jewish. That is what Black Lives Matter is. That is, someone robbed your house, so you call the police, they come in your house, they kill you. And that's what they do. They do it all the time in America. They shoot unarmed Black people all the time. That's what Black Lives Matter is. Stop killing unarmed Black people. Stop it.
Do you think that we have turned a point within the community of understanding and acknowledging these issues? Whilst acknowledging there's a long way to go, do you think we've got better? Do you think we're worse than we were? Do you think
the Jewish community dealing with Black Lives Matter or Black racism, Jewish racism?
Yeah. Where do you think we're at?
I think we're just starting to realize that we have racism in our community. I think we're just there, just a tiny, tiny bit. A lot of Jewish people, yeah, are like, I care about racism, which is an issue over there that I like to support, of the supporting that those people should be fine. And it's like, hey, those people are also us. We are those people, yeah? Mm. Some of us are those people. Some of our children date people of other ethnicities and get ostracized from their families. Some of you might have very nicely adopted a child of a different ethnicity, but you haven't actually dealt with the racism in your own community. Some of us maybe mistreat our employees who are of different ethnic groups. Some of us exploit domestic workers who are of other ethnic groups. We may underpay carers who work in our care homes, wages that British people would not accept, you know, European origin British people. People, also Jewish people, who have this poverty mindset about Africa, that is so racist and narrow-minded, because there are upper class, middle class, normal class, working class, everything in Africa too, just like here. And I find that super offensive, is when you get these people who are like, and there's starving children in Africa. It's like, there's starving children in London.
Is it a question of just these stories being heard in Jewish media more? I mean, media in general, but I'm just saying because it's a Jewish podcast.
So I think that there is an incredible amount of ignorance among some Jewish people, not all, some, who just don't even think about, okay, well, people who are brown come from Africa, and Africa is very different than people who live in the diaspora in the Americas, who had their history and their family interrupted and were robbed and suffered incredible, horrible things that we can't even imagine over hundreds of years. That is very different than people who are living in the African continent who survived colonialism, which also was horrible things happening in the continent. So this is an understanding of history. And like, if we want them to understand us, and we should understand them. And sometimes them and us is the same thing. So, you know, we passively accept that people of all ethnicities are there to serve us, to work for us, our colleagues, our bosses, our nurses, our doctors, our teachers. We passively accept their existence, but then we don't actually learn about them. And we expect them to respect the topic of anti-Semitism. We want them to know about us, and we don't take the time to know about them. I think that's hypocrisy. I think that we need to make sure we're not gatekeeping Judaism as normal Jewish people. Gatekeeping of Judaism is for the literal security guards and the actual rabbis who are marrying people and burying people. So if you're not marrying someone, burying them, or literally keeping the gate, it's none of your business.
Madeline Young, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if all that made you question your own existence, Rabbi Harvey Belofsky has you covered in Talmud for Schmerls.
Talmud for Schmerls.
So for this Talmud for Schmerls, I'm joined by Rabbi Harvey Belofsky of Golders Green Synagogue to talk about whether it's better to be born or not be born. That was an interesting pitch, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you're going to tell me, so go for it.
Hello. I am looking at a piece from the tractate Eruvin. Eruvin, as its name suggests, deals mostly with Shabbat boundaries, how to construct a private space in which people can carry on Shabbat. But as every tractate, there are some interesting digressions. And in the first chapter of this tractate Eruvin, for those who are interested, on page 13b, we have the following gem, Ton Rabbonon. The rabbis taught, Shtei Shonim Umechso. Nechluku Beis Shammai Uveis Hillel. For 2.5 years, the students of the academies of Shammai and Hillel, who were two ancient sages of great importance, who influenced all further Talmudic study, they argued, they disagreed. Halalu Oimrim, Noyach Loila Odom Shlo Nivro, Yose Mishinivro. One group said, you know, it would be better if a person had never been born than to have been born. It's a bit of a miserable story. Better not to have been born. I wonder what they mean. V'halalu omrim, and the other group say, and it doesn't say which is which, note, Noach loyla odom shenivra yosem shelo nivra. No, it will be. It's better to have been born than not to have been born. Now, if you think about it, it's a bit of an academic question, and it's a tongue-in-cheek question because the people who are discussing it have definitionally been born. They and we were not given the option. But in theory, if we were advising God, would it be better for human beings to come into the world? Think about it. There's joy, celebration, the opportunity to change the world, to bring pleasure and joy to other people, to give things to the disadvantaged. But what goes with that is sadness, loss, complexity, pain, death, none of which any of us can avoid. And anyway, we might do lots and lots of mitzvahs, fine, valuable acts that the Torah requires us to perform. But it's also true that we all sin and that weighs against us. So what is the rabbis arguing about? Where does the balance fall? Better to have the opportunities and live with the consequences, or better avoid the consequences and not have to live? Better to avoid the opportunities and not have to live with the consequences. What's the outcome? After 2.5 years, Nimnu v'Gomru, they took a vote. They just could not persuade each other.
That sounds like the Talmud.
That's right. They took a vote. They couldn't persuade you. After they're going on this for 2.5 years, I don't suppose it means they did it every day and every night, but over a period of 2.5 years, this was a constant argument in their yeshivas. And eventually, Nimnu v'Gomru, they took a vote. And what was the outcome? Noach loyla odom shelo nivra yosem shenivra. Actually, it's better that you should not have been born than to have been born. It's a pretty miserable conclusion. The trouble is, it's a completely impractical conclusion. Achshav shenivra, but now that we have been born, that's not a very helpful conclusion. So the Gemara, and we're nearly at the end, there's a few words from the end. What should you do? Given that we have been born, which means we find ourselves in a suboptimal reality, according to this conclusion of the vote in the Talmud, what should we do? Yefashpesh v'maisov. One should examine one's deeds. It means take stock of what you've done in the past. Have a look at what's happened in the past and realize that if things have gone wrong, maybe I'd be better not to have had the opportunity to go wrong in the first place. But given that I went wrong, I might as well take stock and try to improve and correct myself. V'omri lo, and those who say, yemashpesh mamasov, which means something slightly different, it means that you should weigh up one's deeds and act very cautiously, realizing there are always strengths and weaknesses, benefits, a kind of loss and value accounting of what we should do. So the rabbis offer quite a miserable reflection here. But they say, since we have been born and we put in this suboptimal world, at least make the best of it.
Rabbi Harvey Belofsky, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure.
Time for our final feature, the Bagel Broigers.
The Bagel Broigers!
Hello and welcome to the Bagel Broigers. This on the future of gender and Judaism. So just before we begin, it's something that I've mentioned to the panelists, I've mentioned to the live audience here at Linwood Festival. Give us a cheer. Yay! Look at that. Oh, wonderfully trained. That this is a sensitive topic and I want a candid conversation. There are certain controversial issues which I don't mind addressing, and I'm also recognising I am saying this as a straight, white man. Doesn't necessarily make it better, but I recognise it. But just anyone who speaks, just be aware that you are talking about individuals, so just be nice. So I'm just going to introduce... in fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get the panel to introduce themselves so you get used to their voices. So, and you know who's who. I'm just going on the order of who is sat next to me. Daniel, do you want to just introduce yourself and just what you do?
I'm Rabbi Daniel Lichtman. I'm a community rabbi in London for a new community called Makor Chaim, which is in the West Hampstead, Kilburn and Willesden Green area. And I also work for Reform Judaism, running the university students program. Well, I guess one of the things that might be relevant to me being on this panel is that quite a few years ago now, I was a co-founder of Keshet UK as well, which is the LGBT inclusivity kind of campaigning organization in the Jewish community.
Hi, my name's Sally Berkovic. I'm originally from Australia. I've been here about 25 years. I work as a writer. I have another job that's outside of this context. interested in the community, but I'm very interested in the issues of orthodoxy and feminism and the changes that have developed over the last 20 years in particular.
Hi, I'm Michelle Janes. I'm the executive director of LEAD, which is a division of the Jewish Leadership Council. I've worked in education and now working cross-communally, developing leaders, both lay and professional. I'm really, really excited about diversity and inclusion and hope that that can be something that we embed in the work that we do in leadership development.
What I wanted to start with is just a bit about covering where we are and where we've been. So we're not focusing on the future yet. I think it's important to establish where we think the status quo is. So, Sally, do you want to start?
So I'd like to just really reflect on the Orthodox community. And of course, there's many Orthodox communities. So I think we need to take a bit of an approach across the communities. And also, there's a UK perspective, but I think we need to also put that into the context of the global perspective, particularly America and Israel, obviously. I think it's been a very interesting time for Orthodoxy. And I think it's been an interesting time for men, actually, because they've had to adapt to a lot of the changes that are happening in the lives of Orthodox women. So on the one hand, people say, oh, nothing's changed. And I know we'll talk about the future shortly. But in fact, a lot has changed. Orthodox women have become much more literate in terms of understanding Jewish law, in terms of engaging with Jewish texts. They've taken on more rituals. Even in the more Haredi circles, women are now, young girls are having bat mitzvah parties, which they didn't, wasn't taken for granted even 20 years ago. And so the trickle-down effect of from what's happening in the modern Orthodox community to the Haredi community is changing the dynamics within that community. And I actually think Orthodox men are being threatened at one point, at one level, and at the same time are having to, are being very supportive. You have allies as well. So I think the current state is a state of flux, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. Things are not as solidified as people assume that they are in the Orthodox community. That's sort of just as an opener.
So I think that moves quite on nicely to Daniel, because you've got your reform background, right?
Sure. Yeah, so we're coming up to an important anniversary in the Jewish world that I inhabit, which is I think it's the 40th anniversary of the ordination of the first women rabbis at Leo Beck College, and that was Rabbi Jackie Tabak and then Rabbi Julia Neuberger. For me, when I'm a recent graduate of Leo Beck College, I think maybe even the majority of our teachers were women. I mean, there was I'm very lucky, I feel, to have come of age and into being a rabbi in a Jewish world where there really seems to be, at least in the kind of positions, a kind of gender equality. So I'm very grateful for that and really honour the struggles, actually, that took place in the past. I mean, many of my women colleagues who are older than me tell a lot of stories of facing real misogyny and real difficult in reform communities, and that's really changed. We're in a situation now where the head of Leo Beck College, the head of Reform Judaism are both women. And I think it led to a kind of really interesting situation when I was studying at the college where we had, even though it kind of, there was a, it's there's kind of seemed like there was a gender equality, we were still in the midst of obviously studying deeply patriarchal texts. And as a group of, there were three men in my class of seven, there was a constant kind of interrogation for us men of what it meant to be men in that space when we were studying these patriarchal texts. And even if our teachers were women and the majority of our class was women, there was still a sense that many of my female colleagues had of not necessarily belonging or not recognizing themselves in the text and in the institutions. I mean, I was really faced constantly by this question about what is it to be a man in that space who basically I had a real sense that I belong in our tradition and that I kind of have a right to it. In contrast to some of my female colleagues, I was constantly noticing that and trying to work with it. It was quite hard to try and continually work out how to be an ally within that. Yeah, so I think that's the kind of situation in that part of the Jewish world. And I've got all kinds of comments about things in the future, but I think that's for later. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Michelle?
Hi. So I've had an interesting and varied experience in the community. I grew up in the Sephardi Orthodox community, where I sat at the back and the other women around me generally talked and didn't participate, although some did. And the experience that I had growing up was not so positive. And I joined the progressive movements as a teenager and suddenly thought, oh, okay, this is cool, I can join in, and found my place in Judaism and as a Jew in the progressive movements. I worked for the Masorti movement for 5 years, and I'm married to a Reform rabbi who's also practiced his rabbinic career in a liberal synagogue. So aside from the United Synagogue and the Haredi world, I've kind of experienced lots of different places. So feel very grateful, actually, to understand different communities to a certain extent. I feel like, for me, it really is about gender, not just about men and women. And without looking looking forward too much. I feel like we're at a point at which we're starting to think about things together rather than separately. And for me, that's really encouraging. It's not just a conversation about this part or this part of the community, but about how do we behave as a community as a whole, and how do we talk about these things together, and how is it not about one role or another role, but how are the roles that we fulfill in our community taken, and what does that mean for us in the spaces that we want? And I suppose for me, spaces are very important. It's about creating spaces for everybody to be and that people are happy in. And I've found a space for me that I feel great and comfortable in. And I would also really passionately fight for spaces that other people want to hold as well. Even though I don't want to be in them, I think there's validity in that. And I think that's something I'm really mindful of.
I want to come on to something slightly a bit more, because I feel like everyone's done talking points, which is fine, But yeah, this is called the Broigers. I don't like the whole idea of tick box getting these type of people on a panel and whatever. At the same time, it needs to be representative, so I'm balancing these things. I did try and find someone who would come on who is gender non-binary or trans. I couldn't find anybody. Do listen to the LGBT series that I did last June for some of those talks. In the context of that, how should communities deal with the difficulties of gender? So people who either have transitioned, people who are struggling with this, how can you reconcile the theology with the humanity? Who'd like to begin?
I can't reconcile it in the sense that I don't know enough about the humanity comes first. The theological, I have to leave to others, to be frank. I think within Orthodox communities, we have to welcome people as they are. It's about their level of engagement. One tries not to exclude people. One hopes we can do the best that we can. If we're living within a halachic system, and I have things that I can't defend, so I don't want to sort of pretend to defend them. And when I gave my introduction, there are many, many problems within Orthodoxy as well. So I'm not here to defend them, but to try and, we can either try and work around them to be humane. You may have practical problems when it comes to burying somebody. Where does a person who's transitioned sit in an Orthodox shul where there's separate seating? Do they sit as a man? Do they sit as a woman? I don't know what the answers are, actually. And I don't know how many people have left Orthodoxy because of this issue. I suspect many have. That's a shame for Orthodoxy, because we're not enriched by having those people's experiences as part of our whole collective. But if we can't respond to that, to people who don't fit in, we have to do some soul searching about that.
Beyond the, because I know in the, I think it's in the Talmud, they say there's six genders, am I right? Because on the whole, the reason why the six is to try and find a way to fit it into two, right? That's an interpretation I've heard. Because Orthodox Judaism is quite binary, right? So how?
Well, religion, I think religion, we've all been binary until fairly recently, I would have thought. I mean, into the religion is binary. Is there a religion that isn't?
Right, but I'm saying there's been people who are androgynous for millennia, right?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like that's something that has certainly been around for quite a while. Yeah, so it's just about, so the question I just want to ask quickly, is anyone from Orthodoxy actually talking about this, of the practicalities beyond the let's do some learning on it? Are they actually talking about how can we be inclusive, or should we be inclusive?
Yes, there are. There are people, you need to read the Facebook groups. There are Yasoska Katz, Rabbi Yasoska Katz in the States, if people have come across him, working on that, Shmuley Yankelovitz in California. There are Rabbonim who are looking at this issue. There are tshuvot, there are answers to certain questions that individuals bring to the community. It's not an area I'm an expert on, so I don't want to comment beyond that. But it's not something that's being ignored. And I think it would be very unfair to tarnish Orthodoxy as they're just ignoring it, they're burying it under the carpet. Some are. But a lot of people are really trying to work out how to be inclusive and how to be humane.
I think the talking thing for me is important, though. When I'm working leadership development, you're thinking if you've got a problem in front of you, you need to talk about it. You need to actually process it and understand it and think about how people feel about it, because you can't just have one person solve it and everyone go along with it. And I think when you're saying, are you talking about it? That's the starting point for me. And let's be clear as well, in my opinion, I don't think that the progressive movements have got it right yet. We might say, yes, it's fine, they're progressive, they've got it. But no, because not all the spaces are truly inclusive. And actually, Keshet UK have produced some really lovely ways of understanding understanding what inclusivity really genuinely means rather than tolerance. And I think that's really important because it's not enough to have on your website, we're inclusive, come and welcome. It's actually about how you welcome people. And I think Limud this year is a really, really great example. And I said yesterday to a few of the team, it's purposeful this year. And I think that's what we need to do is create purposeful spaces. There are gendered toilets, non-gendered toilets. There are signs. It's part of the dialogue. And I think if it becomes part of our conversation and we don't shy away from, well, how do we deal with where somebody sits? If it's a conversation that you have, people become less afraid of the other and less afraid of the people who they don't know. And starting, I'm so excited to have these badges, the pronoun badges, because I try and start sessions with them.
Just to clarify, these are badges that have on what pronoun you would like to be known by. Carry on.
So I just think having little pointers and having things and signs that make the conversation and space and everything purposeful means that we're mindful and we're open and we're aware, and wherever we sit with it and wherever our conclusions come to, at least we've been through the process.
I'd just like to clarify that I would say that I try and be as much of an ally as I can be, and there are certain things that I still find difficult to get my head around. It's not for me to have to reconcile that. It's for me to, and I'm saying this to anyone in the audience who has trouble reconciling anything to do with gender, it's fine if you struggle with it. Do struggle with it, but just be understanding at the end of it and think about the human at the end. I keep on repeating it because it's really important. Sorry.
I'm curious about when you talk about reconciling between what and what, because in my experience, and I feel this is why I'm a rabbi, this is why I want to dedicate my life to teaching Torah, because Torah is really resilient. Torah's going to be okay. Torah is really, really okay. The more variety of people that have access to reading Torah, access to studying Torah, access to our sacred texts, we will find new understanding, new ways, right? Revelation is continuing all the time as we continue to bring new oral Torah in response to the written Torah that we have. So Torah's fine. Human beings have problems, and our societies and how we're structured have problems. One thing I was reminded of as I was listening to the two of you is an experience that I was very privileged to have, which was I went to the States a couple of years ago and attended the Svara Queer Radical Yeshiva for a week. So I went to a queer Talmud camp, and it's quite a remarkable, remarkable thing. So you have 6 days of being in the Bet Midrash, basically all day, with your chavruta partner within what they call a queer normative space. And there's a theory of Talmud that's being brought as well, which basically understands the rabbis to have been kind of queer in a way, queer in the kind of like broader political sense of that, which means not fitting in or like struggling with how do you bring transformation to something? How do you like find a way to build the structures for you to be, right? Which is what the rabbis were faced with after the destruction of the temple. So within that understanding that the Talmud is a response to rupture, and that the people in the room are living lives that are responding to rupture that's happened within the communities that they've been a part of, the practice of Talmud study became extremely radical and extremely healing. I mean, I just witnessed people weeping as they kind of came to own the Talmud text as their own and be able to find themselves in it.
Should we maybe go on to the future now? Again, no one knows what the future holds. Where do you think we're going? I'm going to keep it as general as that.
I have no idea, but I think I'm excited by it, is all I'd like to say. And I'm excited because I can see I have 2 young children, they're 7 and 9, and I'm excited by the way they see the world and the potential in their openness, and hoping that that can extend, and hoping that those of us who haven't grown up in that space can open our minds a little and be understanding and explore, and free to explore and free to question and to ask. And if we explore and come back to the same place that we were, then that's great as well. I don't think we all have to move. It's okay. Reconciling is hard for me because it kind of, that means settling to me. And I don't know. As long as we've explored and we've found out and we're okay with where we're at rather than just following, that feels good to me. And I think I'm excited by the prospect of exploration and the potential, which is a bit woolly, I realise, and not very committal.
I mean, it's incredibly woolly.
I know. I'll come back. I'll open with something woolly and come back.
I'll be less woolly. Change will come from rich women. I think that the economic drivers of orthodoxy is what's changing it. I think that women philanthropists, and obviously men as well, but the change where you've got wealthier women either inheriting money or who are now professionals and earning enough money, are donating to causes that are changing the shape of orthodoxy. So, for example, the women's seminaries in Israel that are training women that are teaching them Talmud, training them to be halakhic advisors, it's largely driven by women's wealth. And that is changing the nature of orthodoxy. There's a program to train women rabbis, Orthodox women rabbis in New York called Yeshivat Maharat. Then the women need to be placed in jobs. One woman is funding placements for the first year of their job in a community to help offset the costs of her employment. That is threatening men who are not getting those jobs because they don't come with that salary. So women are changing the nature of leadership within communities. These are very small changes in a particular sort of bubble, one could argue, but they are the tipping point for changes that will affect many more communities and have wider ramifications. So at the same time as you've got that radical move, you also have what some of you may have seen as sort of the eradication of women's faces in the Orthodox community. There's been a lot of publicity recently about women being pushed, excluded, you know, photoshopped from IKEA catalogues, if people are familiar with this phenomena. So you have these two things going on in the Orthodox community, tremendous change, and I think the future will be hugely different. And at the same time, this reaction, which is largely about those change, both with it happening within the Orthodox community. In terms of ritual changes, when we first got married, on Shabbat, my husband would make kiddush and I would cut the challah. And I have three girls, and that's what they always saw. And then when we would go to families where, oh, your mother's the feminist, you know. So, and my kids couldn't get their head around the father both doing the kiddush and saying for the bread, the making the bracha over the challah. It's completely transformed now. I mean, many, many families, the women are saying, making hamotzi. Now, that might seem like, oh, what's the big deal? It's actually a huge deal. If you understand the social dynamics, the family dynamics, what is that what that's saying about men letting go of control within a family and within the broader context, I think these are massive, massive changes. And there's just a couple of examples. And at the same time, you'll have the backlash from the more Haredi circles. But anyone who saw a couple of days ago in Haaretz, there was a very large article about Haredi women and Talmud study, and I highly recommend it. A fascinating group of Haredi feminists, they call themselves. That would not have happened 5 years ago. This trickle-down effect within Orthodoxy is very, very interesting. So I think the future's going to be disruptive, drawing on your word. It's already started, but it's going to be even more so.
Yeah, some thoughts I've got going into the future. So the conversation already came up about trans and non-binary people, and I think we don't know what impact is going to be had on our communities through really being able to hear their voices and celebrate their identities. I think that's very interesting. What might happen liturgically, I think that's and it's unknown to me, and I'm looking forward to it. Something that I'm interested in being involved in is also work around Jewish masculinity. And as a man myself, I want to celebrate the opportunities for women to have women's only space to explore some questions that are better explored without men being present. And at the same time, I'm interested in being with other Jewish men, exploring some of the questions around what it is to be a Jewish man. And I guess I would want to do that in a way that this takes on the learnings of feminism and does the work of what it is to be Jewish men, understanding also having privilege as well. I've been on a couple of Jewish men's retreats and it's really, really meaningful. So I think that's something I'd want to bring to more people.
Can I be less woolly?
Yeah.
Just reflecting on the power, I think the power thing really struck me. And I think that's, it's not just in our community, it's not just in Judaism and in our Jewish spaces, it's in the world generally, and understanding diversity and the positivity of diversity and what that brings. So really looking not just at ourselves, but about how we understand power and how we understand influence and diversity, and how we will accept it in one place and not in another sometimes, which always seems a little strange to me. Maybe it's about really understanding where the power is and enabling those around us and lifting up those around us and being open to that as well. And actually it's linked to money as well. You talk about the funding, Sally. It's really important. So how do we, as those who haven't traditionally put into, whether it's with money or with our own efforts or our own voices, find that space? And that's important. And being aware of power, which can be very good and also very destructive.
Right, so I think that rounds us off very, very nicely. I would just like to thank Michelle, Sally and Daniel for being on the panel. Thank you all very, very much for coming. Thank you all very, very much.
Until next time, bagelers.